to Shattering Myths. I am your host, Yetta. For those who would like to engage in this discussion, you can call 877-300-7645. We have David Hayden with us today. David is the author of a new book on Islam's beginning called Muhammad and the Birth of Islamic Supremacism, The War with the Jews, 622 to 628. Now, David, at the end of the last segment, we were talking about the banishment of the Kanuka Jews, the fact that Muhammad struck first. It wasn't his first strike against humankind. You were correct that Nakhla and Badr were his first assaults on humankind. His first assaults, therefore, were on Meccans and fellow Arabs. But then he turned to Jews, and he exiled this entire community, confiscating their homes and properties. What would he do from there? That wasn't the first attack on Jews. It was the first, but it wasn't the last attack on Jews, was it, David?
No, it wasn't. I think that took place approximately in May of 624. And the next attack against Jews was the Banu Nadir. That was in August 625, a little over a year later, year and a half later.
And there was another skirmish, one that Muhammad lost with his fellow Meccans that preceded that, was there not?
Yes, that was the Battle of Uhud. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that correctly, but that was the battle against the Meccans again. But this, in this particular case, the Meccans tried to attack Medina.
And why did the Meccans feel that it was appropriate for them to? And now the Meccans did not have an army, so we can't overgrandize this. The Meccans didn't have an army; they didn't even have a police force. These were nothing but merchants that decided that they needed to go up to Yathrib. Why were the Meccan merchants? Why did they feel compelled to go up to Yathrib?
Because of all the raids on their caravan.
Correct. I mean, correct.
Muhammad, and this comes out in the Sirah also, that Muhammad was trying to provoke a war with them, and he succeeded. After the Battle of Badr, that was one thing. I mean, they, according to the Sirah, the Meccans, the Quraysh were they had something like 3,000 people up there that came to help with the caravan, to protect the caravan, but there were only, 1,000 Muslims. But Muslims were able to defeat them. Of course, they say it's because of Allah. Allah wanted them to win, therefore they won. But these raids continued, and Uhud was an attempt by the Meccans to stop this aggrandizement by Muhammad and his jihadists.
Right, and who lost that battle? I'm even falling into the trap. We call these things battles because they're presented as battles in the Hadith. But we need to keep in mind, Muhammad was not a general. These were not armies. This was simply a group of mujahideen on behalf of Muhammad, militants on behalf of Muhammad, attacking civilians on behalf of Mecca. But in that skirmish, Uhud, who prevailed?
Who prevailed? The Meccans prevailed.
And correct.
According to the story, it was because the Muslims had the upper hand at the beginning, but then they started thinking about the booty, and they started taking stuff off of the men that they killed and so on. And the people that were supposed to protect the rear thought the battle was over, so they rushed down, which enabled a Meccan general, our leader, to bring his men around and to attack them from a different direction, and they ended up routing them.
Okay. Now, there's a parallels here with Genghis Khan. When you get a group of people to be raiders, and you have a failed raid, or you don't continue to satiate the bloodlust and the covetousness of your fighters, you need to satiate that covetousness and that lust in another way. So they were expecting being led by Muhammad and by being inspired by his wannabe god Allah, that they were going not only to trounce the Meccans, but they were going to be able to rob the Meccans of everything they had that was valuable. That did not happen. So what was the consequence of that?
The consequence of their defeat at Uhud?
Yes.
Yes. Well,
they needed an easy prey, didn't they?
They did, but it took, you know, there was about 6 months before they attacked the Nader in Medina. But there were other attempts in the interim.
Mm-hmm.
Consolidate their power. I think this is the time that they Muhammad sent somebody to assassinate one of the Banu Liyan leaders down
mm-hmm.
close to Mecca because they considered him like the guy who's organizing too many people to attack Muhammad. And he was assassinated, but it kind of backfired in some ways because the groups that saw this leader as someone that they wanted to get revenge for, led some Muslims into a trap and killed them. And so there were other attempts by Muhammad at this time to raid people that various tribes in between Mecca and Medina to make sure that they weren't going to be successful in attacking the Muslims. So there were these skirmishes that went on, but then one of the skirmishes led to the situation with the Banu Nader, and that was a Muslim misunderstood a couple of the I forgot which tribe it was that he murdered, thinking that they were the ones that were responsible for killing the Muslim at a well. And because he killed the wrong people, Muhammad said that Muhammad had to pay a blood white or a blood wit,
mm-hmm.
which meant that because his tribe attacked and killed these people for no good reason, that he had to pay them for the death. So he went to the Banu Nader and asked them to contribute to
right.
this because Banu Nader
didn't have. They were rich and he had no money.
That's exactly right. You know, you wonder what happened to his richness that he got from the Kainuka, I guess. But anyway.
So they squandered it. You know, if you don't earn money, if you simply steal it, you have no sense of its value. And it is easily squandered. So they squandered everything they had stolen. And now Muhammad was obligated to, by Arab custom, to pay blood money. He was broke. And so he went to the people that he had been harassing, the brothers of the people that he had just exiled, and said, why don't you supply the money for me?
Right. And they actually, according to the story, I've read other interpretations of this, but the original story, I think it was from Ishaq, was that they agreed to do it. Then they, according to the story, they told Muhammad just to stick around. They were gonna go up and cook a meal for him over this, you know, this agreement that he was going to pay the money. But then Muhammad got a message from Allah saying, you need to get out of there. They're gonna kill you. Drop a rock on your head. So
now, what part of that story? Seems true to you? What part of that story is credible to you?
Well, what part's credible?
Yes. Do you think that the Nadar, having witnessed Muhammad exile their brothers, the Kanuka, from their homes, are now going to fund Muhammad's bloodlust when he went and killed somebody else?
Right. Right. And plus, you know, dropping a rock on his head from above, I guess that could work, but, you know, he was in their territory.
Right.
He just had a couple of his companions with him. They could have wiped them out easily.
If
they really were serious about killing him, they would have done
it. So, in other words, what we're doing here is we're Muhammad's trying to get justification for now exiling the second group of Jews, correct?
Pretty much.
And his story, if you're informed and rational, his justification is irrational.
Yes, it is.
Okay, so what did he do to the Banu Nadir?
Well, he exiled them, too. But at first there was an attack of the... Well, he sent a messenger to them saying, look, I found out that you guys are going to try to kill me, mm-hmm. so you have to leave my land. You have to leave my country. I don't remember the exact words, but it was
right.
It was, you know, it's just unbelievable. It's,
I thought he was the immigrant.
They're responsible. Yeah, right. They're responsible. They've lived there for 500 years at least, and they're responsible for trying to kill him when all he hears is a message from Allah saying, hey, they're going to drop a rock on your head. You need to get out of there. He leaves his friends there and goes home.
Yeah, they had probably lived there for longer than that. Because they were actually, they moved there because after the Assyrians and Babylonians assaulted the northern kingdom of Israel during what was probably the 6th century BCE, when they were finally freed to go back to Israel from what
Babylon?
Is the same, yeah, from Babylon and from Assyria, from Mesopotamia. Many of them chose to stay in the area rather than take the long march through the desert. And so it is likely that the Jewish communities in Yathrib had been there for close to 1,000 years.
Yeah, I talk about that on page one of the book, the different stories about when the Jews arrived there. And that's one of the stories that I talk about.
So Muhammad, the irrational...
Go ahead.
So I was just saying, so Muhammad the Irrational One tells the Jews who had been there for 1,000 years to leave his country.
Right, exactly. And they send a message back and say, well, we're not leaving. And so they started the war because they refused to leave their homes and their livelihood. So he attacked them. And this went on for 2 weeks or so. And they eventually decide that, you know, they thought they were going to get help from the Karaiza and the
mm-hmm.
and some other tribes in the area, the Gatafana, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
But they weren't forthcoming. So they were defeated. Well, they surrendered because
yes,
they just couldn't hold out. The interesting thing is that in every case, the Muslims are attacking Jewish property. In
mm-hmm.
every case.
Yes, and confiscating
always,
it.
And it's always the Jews' fault.
Right. Yes. Just as they're attacking Israel today, and they blame their attack on Israel today as if it were the Jews' fault. We've moved forward 1,300 years in time, but the story is identical. And if you want to understand what is happening today with the continued onslaught of Islamic terrorism, you have to turn back the pages 1,300 years, and it would help if you read David Hayden's book. I am Yada. This is Shattering Myths. Good morning and welcome back to Shattering Myths. I'm your host, Yada. We're having a conversation with David Hayden, who has written a book on Islamic terrorism, its beginnings. It's entitled Muhammad and the Birth of Islamic Supremacism, The War with the Jews, 622 to 628. So, David, we have talked about the Muhammad's initial plans to be a... to declare war on all humankind with the Pledge of Aqaba. We have talked about the Nakla raid where he struck first blood against his hometown and the caravanners in his hometown. We talked about how he exiled, stealing the property of the Kanuka Jews. We talked about how he has now exiled the Nadir Jews, sending them off into the desert to die while stealing their property and their possessions. But that's not the end of the story, is it?
No, it's not.
In fact, it gets much worse, doesn't it?
Most definitely. I mean, if we go back to the Kanuka, he originally wanted to behead the men of Kanuka, but there was a man who's called a hypocrite throughout the era. He was actually, before Muhammad arrived, he was a member of the Oz tribe. And the Oz tribe were friends with the Kainuka. Whereas the Karaiza Jews and the Nadir Jews were friends of the, they were friends of the Khazraj. And the Karaiza and the Nadir were friends with the Oz tribe. So there was the conflict before Muhammad got there between these groups. But the Jews weren't monolithic. I mean, they weren't all just, you know, set by themselves. They actually had relationships with the people who lived near to them.
Yeah, it's just like people today. I mean, you, no matter if you were dealing with an ethnic group or a religious group today, very few people are monolithic in their nature. So Muhammad capitalizes on this, and now he's confiscated the property of two of the three Jewish communities in Yathrib, which means he has confiscated the majority of the wealth of the inhabitants of Yathrib. Where does he turn his attention next?
Well, it takes a while, but because the Battle of the Ditch takes place around March 627. So this is about a year and a half after the Nadir are exiled. But he's really concerned about the Nadir because basically a lot of them went up to Kabar, which is about 50 to 70 miles north of Medina. And maybe some of them went further into Syria and so on. But a lot of them, especially some of the leaders of the Nadir, who I think really wanted to try to stop Muhammad from doing what he was doing, were looking for allies up there. And in that interim period before the Battle of the Ditch, there were a lot of raids by Muhammad to stop any kind of alliance from taking place. Then he also had the problem with the Khareza Jews. They were ostensibly not so much on his side, but had an alliance with him in terms of they weren't going to try to do anything to harm the Muslims there.
Okay, I'm going to ask you a question again, David. Yeah. I've asked you this in the previously, and you have answered rationally. The alliance with the Khareza Jews being broken is then used as the justification for Muhammad killing them, enslaving them, and exiling them. Based upon what Muhammad has done to the Kanuka and the Nadir and what he has done to his own people, do you think there's any chance that the Khareza Jews are correctly presented as having formed an alliance with Muhammad and breaking that as the justification for them being murdered?
Yeah, that definitely was the justification for their being murdered.
Oh, that is the justification that Muslims are told. Do you think it's true? Is it rational? Is it credible?
Is it credible? Based on his behavior before this, it is. I mean, if he believed that. But
yeah, we would disagree on that point. Well, I don't think it is. I don't think it. I've studied the alleged compact, which of course no one has a copy of, between the Khareza and Muhammad. And based upon Muhammad's action in having exiled the Kanuka and exiled the Nadir and having turned on his hometown, terrorizing its caravans, I think it's not credible that Muhammad and the Khareza actually had a pact of peace between them. I think it is only stated for the same reason that the other justifications were stated, for the express purpose of giving Muhammad justification for the savage abuse that he would lay upon these people. We'll be back in a moment. This is Shattering Myths.
You know what happened?
To Shattering Myths, we're having a discussion with David Hayden, who's the author of Muhammad and the Birth of Islamic Supremacism, his war with the Jews. So, David, we've finished with the Kanuka, we finished with the Nadir. You've mentioned the Battle of the Ditch, which was the second attempt by the Meccans to thwart Muhammad's consistent terrorizing of them and robbing of them. That ended without the Muslims being able to satiate their desire for blood and for booty. And so now with Yathrib no longer under siege, what did Muhammad do? He turned to the Khareza, did he not? What did he do to the Khareza, David?
Ultimately, he had the men beheaded, and he enslaved the women and children. and confiscated all their wealth.
And the women that he enslaved, what did the Muslim men, including Muhammad, do with the women that they enslaved?
Well, they had the right, according to Allah, to do whatever their right hand owns, or I forgot the exact terminology, but what, in other words, they could do whatever they wanted to with their slaves. So they're pretty much open to
peace. And they raped them, did they not?
Yes, but you'd have to call it that.
Yeah, forced sex is rape. We can use the correct term. This show is not politically correct. It attempts to be correct. They raped the women, and they enslaved the children, correct?
Yeah,
and they stole their property. So we have a trend here in terms of stealing the property. The only difference is there were 800 or 900 men who were beheaded in the marketplace of Yathrib on this day, correct?
That's true.
And who was there? Who witnessed and orchestrated the beheading of these men one at a time?
Well, the sources tell me different things. One says that Muhammad did it, that Muhammad was involved in it, that he was beheading them. Even Aisha, his 13-year-old at this time, she's 13 at this point, said in a hadith that while Muhammad was out, beheading the men, she was talking to this woman who was going to be beheaded also because she had somebody.
Right, it's a horrible story.
So Aisha is corroborating that story. But then there are other people that say that wasn't true, that it was that two of Muhammad's men led the beheadings, and that he wasn't directly involved. But really, that I spent a lot of time talking about Ibn Saad.
Yes.
Who was a convert after Muhammad arrived to Medina. Mm-hmm. And Ibn Saad, throughout his relationship with Muhammad, starting with the Battle of Badr, even maybe before that, was a true believing Muslim. And he converted. When he converted, his whole tribe converted, whether they wanted to or not. They were converted also. And he was the guy that Muhammad chose. You know, the apologists for Islam say, well, Muhammad didn't. He didn't do it. It was Ibn Saad. But he knew exactly what was in Ibn Saad's mind.
Well, yeah. Well, he asked Ibn Saad, what's your verdict? And Ibn Saad says, kill their men and enslave their women and children. And what did Muhammad say after he received that from Ibn Saad? He said, that is the declaration from Allah.
Exactly. From the heavens.
Right.
Yeah. It's right there. And
yeah, so it's obvious that Muhammad orchestrated this. If his pedophilic wife, Aisha, who was 6 when Muhammad first married her, is now 13, says in her testimony that Muhammad himself participated in the beheadings, the very best that can be said of him is that he supervised them, orchestrated them, and sat there like an emperor over some ghoulish act in the Colosseum. But this was in Yathrib's marketplace.
Right, right. That's true.
But it gets worse.
I think... Go ahead.
Yeah, it gets worse. And by the way, the Quran itself boasts about this, where Allah himself says that he was responsible for terrorizing the Jews, killing the ones that were killed and enslaving those that were enslaved. And it was Allah who made it possible for the Jews, for the Muslims, to steal their property.
Right. And like I said earlier, Allah tends to do this in most of these episodes.
Right, so Allah then would be a rapist.
He's the one that created terror in the Jewish, that Quraysh's mind to make them come out of their strongholds.
Right, so Allah is admitting that he is a terrorist. Allah is admitting that he is he's a rapist. Allah is saying that he is a mass murderer. Allah is saying that he's a thief.
Yeah, the record would show that.
Yeah, that's what the Quran says. All right, so we have the murder of the Quraysh men. We have the enslavement of the Quraysh children. We have the rape of the Quraysh women at Muhammad's hand and instruction. That leads us then to the Treaty of Hudaybiyah and the aftermath of that treaty, which was the raid on Kabar.
Right.
Can you summarize the Treaty of Hudaybiyah for us, and then we'll have you tell us what happened at Kabar.
Okay, well, the Treaty of Hudaybiyah, Muhammad this, again, this is very shortly before Kmart. But
yes,
I don't remember the exact detail here, but he had it in his mind that he should make the lesser pilgrimage to Mecca, and that they were, and he wanted people to go with him, and he took a large number of people down to Mecca with him. They didn't quite make it to Mecca. The Quraysh heard that they were coming, and they didn't want them to go in. It would really look bad if they allowed them to come in, but it would look bad also if they fought them because they were coming peacefully, and that would just look bad to stop people from coming down to pay homage to their god.
To their rock god, Allah, in his rock garden called the Kaaba. All right, so they stop him, and Muhammad now is in a real pickle because he has insufficient men under arms to confront the Meccans, who, mind you, are only merchants. And he forms a treaty. What's the gist of that treaty?
It's really strange because some of the more true-believing Muslims really got upset with this treaty. They were upset with Muhammad and said, what's going on? I thought people of God. Why are you doing this? But it pretty much was very favorable to the Meccans on the surface.
Yeah, Muhammad acknowledges that he's not the messenger. He denies that he's the messenger of Allah. And then he says that I make my written commitment that neither I nor my followers will rob you, will terrorize you, will kill or kidnap Meccans for the next 10 years.
That's true. Yeah, 10-year treaty.
Right. And so Muhammad is, by signing this treaty, he is acknowledging that the thing that he has been doing during the past 10 years is kidnapping Meccans, robbing Meccans, killing Meccans, enslaving Meccans. And so he's acknowledging that's what he has done over these past 10 years and that he's going to refrain from doing so for the next 10 years.
That's true.
And so, now
the Meccans agree in the agreement also it says that Muhammad will not go into Mecca at this time, but he can come back next year.
Oh yeah, and he does, doesn't he?
He comes back all right.
Yeah. Now, before we get to him coming back, so now you have the third encounter in a row between the first Muslims led by their wannabe God and their wannabe prophet, and they encountered the third encounter now with the Meccan merchants, and the Muslims walk away with no bloodlust and no booty. So what do the first Muslims do on their way back to Yathrib now with their tail between their legs?
Well, they're pretty upset, and this is when they're talking to Muhammad about, you know, what's going on here. You know, deep down, there's a lot of people that are more interested in booty probably than they were in helping.
Oh, of course, So what did they do on the way home? Because there's a farming community there with the last Jewish community of any consequence in Western Arabia. What was the name of that farming community, and what happened there?
And you're talking about Kbar.
Yeah, that's one.
Yes. Well, they. About a month after Hudaybiyah, they attacked it. And when Muhammad arrived, it said that they stopped outside the gate, the approach to Kbar, and said that he's going to wait for the early morning prayer. And if they hear it, they're not going to attack. But if they didn't hear it, they were going in. Well, when dawn came, they called the prayer. It was not being recited, which is telling him, okay, this is not Muslim property yet. So they went in. And the Kbar farmers were coming out with their shovels and, you know, their farming equipment, getting ready to work, and they saw Muhammad coming, and they ran away, ran back in, and that's when he yelled, Allahu Akbar, and talked about, the punishment is coming for those who have been warned.
Yeah, so Allahu Akbar is called the Islamic prayer of fear, and it means Allah is greater. And it was being yelled at the former community from Yathrib. These would be Yahudim. That's the actual name of a Jew. Jews is Yahudim. It means those who are related to Yah, and they're from Yathrib. And now to these Yahudim who are related to Yah, he has his people say that Allah is greater. So he's saying Allah is greater than the God of the Yehudim, who is Yahweh.
Right.
And is not Allahu Akbar still the prayer of fear uttered by most every Islamic terrorist, such as those who flew the planes into our buildings on September 11th?
Yeah, that's the last lines of my book. I go through several historical incidents where they're yelling Allahu Akbar as they approach. And you hear this a lot, especially in the Middle East, you know, concerning Israel and the going to be attacked again. And they're constantly making references to Kabar.
Yes.
Kabar, you know, that we were going to return and all this stuff. So,
correct.
Yeah, it's been used throughout history.
Yeah, so if you understand what Muhammad did at Kabar, you will understand what Muslims are doing to Israel today.
Yes, including today. I mean, today, this day.
This day, this very day, as they're firing Kabar rockets into Israel.
Yes. Yeah.
And screaming Allahu Akbar in the process.
Yeah, they may throw a few K-bars in there, too. You never know.
Yes. So what happened? We've got Muhammad now. He's acknowledging that Allah, his God, is greater than the Jewish God, who is Yahweh, the only true God, as a matter of fact. And he is now beginning a terrorist attack because his group is armed. This is a civilian community. He's beginning that on Kabar. Now, we'll have to return to that story of what happens in Kabar. After the break, we're concluding our conversation with David Hayden, the author of Muhammad and the Birth of Islamic Supremacism, The War with the Jews. I am Yada. This is Shattering Myths. Today, I'm your host, Yada. We're having a discussion with David Hayden, the author of a book, Muhammad and the Birth of Islamic Supremacism, The War with the Jews. And David said something at the end of the last segment that I think is extraordinarily important. What happened to the Jews and in Kabar was designed to be a warning to all Jews and to all people for all time thereafter as to what Muslims intended to do. You either surrender to Islam, or what happened at Kabar is what Muslims are waiting to do to you, because their lone prophet Muhammad told them that Kabar would set the example for how Muslims would respond to non-Muslims, and especially Jews, throughout time. So what did the armed militants surrounding Kabar do to the farming community that was unarmed?
Well, the weird thing is that, you know, some of the sources say they were definitely armed and they were the most powerful military force in the area. But it just certainly didn't seem
that way. Okay.
I mean, okay. I thought that didn't make any sense.
No, it doesn't anyway, make any. If it doesn't make any sense, is it true?
I don't think so.
Okay. All right. So what happened?
Well, they were spread out. They had different castles in various places in Kabar. It's not just a small little town. It was just a spread out area, and they weren't united. They were just farming communities, and they basically the Muslims just methodically attacked one castle at a time. Until
yes.
Finally, when they got down, there were only about two left. They finally gave up.
Yeah, fortress kind of more than a castle, but yes, they attacked one after another after another after another.
Right.
And when the final one was left, and what did they do again to the men? What did they do to the men?
Well, a lot of the men were killed in the battle. There were probably more people killed in this battle than the other battles.
Okay, and the women, what did they do with the women?
The women were enslaved. And
yeah, and Muhammad himself was one of the rapists, wasn't he?
Well, yeah, he ended up with a woman called Safiya.
Yeah.
And she lived with him until she died.
She was a concubine kept by Muhammad, and he raped her the evening after he had killed her father and her husband.
Right. And
all right, so they killed the men, they raped the women, and they enslaved the children.
Yeah, but the way I interpret it, they didn't kill all the men like they did with the Quraysh.
No, there was one. There was a community of Kabar left that surrendered to Muhammad. And with that community, what was the agreement that Muhammad made with that community?
Well, basically, the agreement was that they were to turn over all their wealth to them, including gold. And
word got
out that Kinana, one of the Jewish leaders, was hiding some gold. And he called Kinana in and told him, look, if we find out you're lying here, you know we're going to kill you. And he said, yes.
Well, it was worse than killing. They tortured him, didn't they?
That's true. That's the story, that he was tortured, and then he was beheaded by a Muslima, which is one of the Muhammad's jihadists.
Yeah, David, we've got to wrap up our interview at this point because I do have a call that I promised to answer. You've done a marvelous bit of research. I hope to have you on again because I'd like to talk about what happened even after the raid of Kabar. You're extraordinarily well informed. I would recommend to everyone that they buy and read Muhammad and the Birth of Islamic Supremacism. Now, at this time, let me bring Glenn on. Glenn has held for a long period of time. Glenn, I understand you have a question.
Yes. Good morning, Adam. Good morning to you.
Yes, thank you.
I don't know his name. I'm a frequent bigger listener. I listen to a lot of programs of CSN.
Mm-hmm.
I just came across your program recently, and this is only about the third or fourth time I've listened. And I'm trying to figure out exactly where you're coming from in terms of school of thought. You know, do you publish any, like, autobiographical information on a website or anything like that, or so that we can.
All right, let me answer your question, Glenn. My first comment is that I should be completely irrelevant to the information that we're providing. The whole purpose of the program is to expose people to the truth. I want people to be informed. That's why we had David as a guest. I want people to be informed so they understand what is happening around the world. As it relates to what I have come to know and understand, the book that I would most encourage you to read, Glenn, is called Intro to God. You'll find it at introtogod.org. I would also encourage you to read yadayah.com. And on the subject of Islam that we've been discussing with David today, prophetofdoom.net. So if you go to prophetofdoom.net, yadayah.com, or introtogod.org, you will find everything you need to know that forms the basis of the conclusions that are presented in this program. I am Yada. This is Shattering Mist. Thank you, David, for being part of the program today. May God bless you all.
Hi, I'm Dr. Joel Wallach, the Dead Doctors Don't Lie guy. There's no reason why you shouldn't live...